Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. Woo! Ladies and gentlemen, episode 123. My goodness. This is like episode 123, take 16. It's just been ridiculous. Absolutely crazy. It's kind of been one of those weeks. You may have noticed by the fact that you got a rerun 2 days in a row. So I had really bad insomnia for a couple of nights. That happens to me sometimes. Just brutal insomnia. And so I was a little ragged and running behind, and I had a lot going on this week. Tons of meetings and a big event tonight. Father Giertek, the theologian to the papal household, is speaking at the institute where I have my day job / primary client for my consulting company at the Augustine Institute. And so I had a lot of stuff to get ready for that event tonight. And over the weekend, so like Sunday night, I couldn't sleep, and I bought a new wireless mouse. I'm just going to vent today a little bit. We're going to get to something in the second segment. We're going to start talking about something substantial, but I got to vent for a second. So, because I get accused of being like the cult of the Mac and all that, and I am kind of a Mac fanboy, I admit it. But so I bought a new wireless mouse, the Magic Mouse from Apple. You know, the cool, it's got like the little thing on top you can use for like gestures and stuff, and I like it. Cool, I've always wanted one. My mouse died. I had kind of a cheap mouse and it died. I had a lot of design work to do and a big old presentation for a meeting this morning to prepare for, so I wanted a decent mouse, and I've been meaning to kind of get set up and get my laptop raised up and get a separate keyboard so I quit stooping over so much, because I spend so much time at my desk. I'm like, you know what? So I went to Best Buy, got me the Magic wireless keyboard and the Magic mouse, and brought them back, and I had to upgrade. So I was lagging behind. I had never upgraded my operating system to El Capitan, the 10... OS 10.11, I think it is. So I upgrade to the new operating system for the Apple, and it broke stuff. Now, in Apple's defense, it broke third-party software and stuff like that, and just didn't. It broke some stuff. Nothing that it broke was Mac broken. Though it didn't act like it wanted to let me connect to my iCloud, but I got that fixed pretty quickly. And so I went to record on Monday. This is excuse for rerun number one. So I went to record on Monday, and things were just completely, anyway, I can't remember if this was Monday or not. Anyway, long story short, on top of the insomnia and being half asleep and running around like a madman, the program that I use acted like it was completely broke. It just didn't work at all. And nothing would record with my mic. I tried different programs. Nothing would record. I was freaking out. Finally, I just figured out that I needed to add that mic back in the system. I guess the upgrade erased my mic that I had added. Which, okay, that's weird. Why? And then I Sorry, I was getting I'm getting messages from my producer, Ethan. You're a rock star, Ethan. I'm recording very late, over my deadline. So I finally got that added back in. Thought I had it handled, but it was too late to get a show in on Monday. That's what it was. So then yesterday I sat down and got ready to record, and I was recording at the last minute again because it's been that week for sure. And then I said, okay, it worked. So I recorded the entire first segment, and it worked beautifully. And I hit pause, and I opened up a new track, and I started the second segment. And the thing just quit. It wouldn't go over 15 seconds. So I still haven't figured that out. So you're hearing me, if I sound a little different than I am normally by myself, I am recording on the little professional portable rig that I use when I do interviews. So it's just me, but I'm on my interview setup. So if I sound a little weird, think about what I normally sound like when I'm interviewing someone, and hopefully that's what I sound like. I'm not even holding out my breath that something's not going to go wrong and you're even going to hear this. It's like, it has been that week, man. But I'm off tomorrow for the most part. I've got a little bit of stuff to do for work, but my goal tomorrow is to get all my tech back online so I can be back in my nice and normal environment. And because it's amazing how much it changes being in a different place or being using different software, different hardware or something. The good news about this is I have a lavalier mic on, and I think that I could probably get away with taking a drink of coffee without slurping in your ear. Because I definitely need coffee today. But so anyway, yeah, that's been my week so far. Oh, and then today I went and bought wine for tonight's event, and I bought this cheese tray, which they messed up. So I got them to fix the cheese tray, went, put the cheese tray into the shopping cart, whole cheese tray went sideways. So after I get done recording this that you're listening to right now, I get to go upstairs, refill the coffee cup, wash my hands, put on an apron, and pick through by hand probably 300 or 400 cubes and pieces of cheese and rearrange and rebuild an entire giant cheese tray for tonight's event so that the good people of Denver that come out to listen to our theologian to the papal household speak about wonderful and beautiful things won't have to try to figure out what each cheese is. So, okay, rant over. There you go. On the bright side, after a little bit of a winter scare with a forecasted decent snowstorm, which turned out to be not much of a snowstorm at all, we're back to our unseasonably weird spring weather here in Denver, Colorado. And it is an absolutely gorgeous day. It's a little crisp, but just sunny. Gorgeous. I wish I was not stuck inside today. Also, maybe I'll work on my computer from a picnic table tomorrow. See if I can't fix my program and all of that without sitting inside. So, so that's what's been going on. Looks like Trump has had a big victory. What was it out there in Nevada? I'm going to go on the record and say I haven't talked hardly at all about the presidential election. I swore to myself, because I was starting this show right as the presidential primaries were starting. And every time this happens, every time there's an election cycle, I am really prone to just, expand my cable package, sit and just flip through news channels every moment I have. Every time I'm working, I've got news on in the background and I'm watching every little story and arguing and commenting and going on and on about presidential politics. And I told myself that I was not going to do that this time. And I haven't. I've been really good. I've been almost negligent. I've been following it enough to see kind of what I think's going on. But I tell you what, I am just beside myself that Donald Trump is getting as far as he is, that he's doing as well as he is. I'm amazed. The guy was just nothing even remotely conservative a few years ago, other than he just likes money a lot, so that makes him a Republican in some ways. But he has been pro-choice, has said on national television that he would never run for president, and if he did, he would switch and run as a Republican, or he'd run as a Republican because they're the stupidest and the easiest to manipulate. And people are like, oh, I don't care. And he's just shouting the most xenophobic, weird stuff, and I just don't understand. I think that people are, he found a moment where so many people that are conservative, or especially, you know, if they're very, you know, evangelicals or whatever, and they're just scared to death that Hillary is going to be president, that they're all just willing to look past whatever it takes to find someone that can beat Hillary. And man, I'm 45 years old, and I have voted for what I consider to be the lesser of two evils, or the, you have to vote for this person because a vote for someone else is a vote for the person we can't let in. That's been my option every single time I have voted in a presidential election since I turned 18 in 1988, 89. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. And I'm over it. I swear, if it comes down to Trump versus Hillary, I'm voting third party. I don't care if I'm throwing my vote away. Somebody has to send a message. I'm going to write in Rand Paul. And on that note, here, I'm just going to write it down on this paper. Rand Paul. See, I just did it. I just wrote it down on this paper. I wrote in Rand Paul right on my notebook. I'm practicing. So you hear me, Republican Party? I'm practicing. If you give me another no-talent jerk face to vote for, I'm going to write in Rand Paul. Okay, let's get listening to the counterposition. Let's go to the break, and we'll talk about something actually interesting when we get back. Thanks for coming out.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so my first segment was me griping about technology, cheese trays, and Donald Trump. I mean, I tell you what, that kind of sums up my week so far. But I'm sick of my week, and I'm sick of Donald Trump, and I'm sick of cheese trays. So we're going to talk about something completely different. You know, I want to start getting like some samples. Wouldn't it be great if we had some samples? I want to get some samples. I just want to be able to hit a button and it say, you know, and now for something completely different, like from Monty Python. How spectacular would that be? All right, so in the news since last we spoke, the BBC did a documentary about John Paul II and his deeply personal, affectionate, relationship with Dr. Anna Teresa Temenyeka, I believe is how you say her name. And the proverbial poop hit the rotary, rotary air device or whatever. They didn't actually come out and say that the Pope had an affair or even that the Pope was in love with this woman or something, but they drug out these people to say that you know, oh, well, no, I mean, you should, you know, the way, you know, that one guy that they drug out was called a trainee priest. Last, back in the 50s, he was a trainee priest. I think we call that a seminarian. I think they've always called that a seminarian. But a trainee priest. But maybe he was just trying to be non-lingo, you know, relevant to the public sphere here. But, you know, and he, and then this trainee priest said, oh, you know, the way we were trained back when I was being trainee. I'm sorry, I can't get over the trainee priest thing. Back when we were being trained, that would definitely have been red flags and a relationship that we would have been told to cut off. And that would just be, that's just dangerous. And they had a couple different people come on and go, oh, yeah, there's clearly something there. You know, listen, look at the language. And they're taking all these quotes out of context and comparing it to notes he had written to other friends that were academics as well. And I guess I haven't seen the thing yet. I heard there was a, you know, there's a picture of him with her standing next to a car that looks like they're very, you know, affectionate or whatever. And as someone pointed out, I think it was Bill Donahue over at TOB, one of these articles I read on this, is that one thing you need to notice is that they weren't alone when that picture was taken. Because there was someone taking the picture, most likely the woman's husband. The three used to hang out together. And so, but the, you know, good things happen out of idiotic things sometimes. And this dropped right at the time that a great article by D.C. McAllister, I think that's what she writes, and Denise C. McAllister, she wrote an article in The Federalist called How to Stop Sexualizing Everything. And Bill Donaghy, I don't know exactly how you say his name. I think I've met the man, but I don't know how he pronounces his name. Bill, D-O-N-A-G-H-Y, Bill Donaghy, over at the TOB Institute. That's T-O-B as in Theology of the Body, tobinstitutes.org/blog. He wrote an article called Holy Friendship in a Hypersexual World. And these two things could not have come. Well, obviously, he's responded. The How to Stop Sexualizing Everything from over at the Federalist could not have come at a better time. And Donaghy kind of picks up on that thread and really uses this article over here to comment on kind of what they're implying with this situation with John Paul II. So let's kind of get the big bird's eye picture of what we want to talk about today. For starters, the big takeaway is that when it comes to persons in relationships with other people, we tend to think that if you have very, very strong feelings and very strong emotional connection and strong feelings towards a person that is not in your immediate family, then those things are sexual in some way. Or they're implied that there must be something going on there. What Karol Wojtyła, John Paul II, would call the masters of suspicion or the politics of suspicion. It's this idea that really intense feelings between persons that are positive feelings are inherently, they're one of two things. They're either sexual or they're repressed sexual. It's like, I love how, I'm going to, quick aside, I just love how we've made these dichotomies, you know? It's like, things are either sex, and that's good, and it's awesome, or it's naughty, naughty, and you're a hypocrite for saying that it's not sexual, or it's repression. Those are the two options, sex or repression. The other ones are just pure matter and, you know, ones and zeros of the where atoms happen to be in some geometrical space, or just revealed revelation that you just have to take this blind leap in the dark. So you've got ones and zeros, atoms in the space in between them, or the spaghetti monster lives behind the sun, and I just really believe that he's sending me the purple marshmallows. Even though I can't see them, they're invisible, warm, fuzzy purple marshmallows, and if I just believe in their marshmallows, I mean, you have this weird dichotomy. We have all these dichotomies, you know, of, you know, the and if there's anything that is characterizes the Catholic world, I'd say it's the it's kind of that both and, or kind of this this breakdown of unnecessary dualisms, if we want to use a big word, you know. It's the or just, if nothing else, just a third option, that not everything isn't seen. It's so funny, we get kind of blamed, the religious world gets kind of blamed in the media for being so black and white. Everything's black and white, black and white. But really, it seems to me that traditional kind of Western, the traditional Western intellectual view of the world, the people, and I'm saying the learned Catholics, the great books readers, the traditional kind of Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, but of the more traditional stripe that are kind of well-read and still anchored to the Western tradition, are some of the last people in this world that are willing to kind of actually make a nuanced argument or make a nuanced look at a situation. So there's an aside where there's a plea for nuance and a gripe of disgust at having to break everything into weird black and white pieces. So anyway, this idea that if you have really strong feelings for someone, then you basically, that's sexual. And so McAllister, in this article over on The Federalist called How to Stop Sexualizing Everything. Man, I tell you what, I cannot recommend enough going over to The Federalist and having a look at this this article. I think this is one of the most important articles written in a really long time that's been floating around the old internets, interwebs, the intertubes out there. It's a system of tubes, if I remember. Wasn't what Biden said? I'm spiky and partisan today. I admit it. I'm a little spiky today. I get that way when I'm frustrated. So I hold here in my, right here in my formerly dark roast stained fingers here, this article, How to Stop Sexualizing Everything. And it is spectacular. She starts off with this really great interaction between her and her 15-year-old daughter, where she's talking on the phone with her friend Leslie, a woman, and she said, hey, I'll talk to you later. I love you. And her daughter is like, well, that's kind of gay, don't you think? And she says, it's not gay. And she says, I have friends I kiss too, on the lips. I hug them, and I'm excited when I see them. I adore them, and I'm devoted to them. I have friends who captivate me with their beauty and intelligence. I tell them so. I tell them I think they're beautiful and amazing. It's nothing sexual. It's phileo. Now, phileo is a Greek word for friendship, love. And that is what we want to talk about. Because I think that friendship, deep, passionate, true friendships are on their way out the door to a certain extent. And I think there's going to be a massive loss to society when that happens. And I think that McAllister has written beautifully about the road that they may travel if they do leave, the road friendship might travel if it heads out of town. So when we get back, we're going to kind of dig into this article a little bit and talk about that, and then we're going to move on to the article by Bill Donegan. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Wade.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so we're talking about the article How to Stop Sexualizing Everything by DC McAllister over at thefederalist.com. I cannot recommend it enough. So after this interaction with her daughter, she talks about that and she kind of mocks the whole bromance thing. Now, the only thing I have is a problem with her in this bromance thing is she includes Jonathan and David in her her bromance. And I think that Jonathan and David in the Old Testament actually had the type of friendship that she's saying we need to save and recover and have more of, not the bromances of, you know, Clooney and Pitt or, you know, Adam Levine and Shelton on The Voice or something. You know, that those are bromances. I think that David and Jonathan are positioned as having a really, really true, deep friendship, not a bromance. But she has a great... I'm tempted to just sit here and read this article to you. This is so good. She has a great quote. She brings C.S. Lewis to the stand and has him give testimony about what friendship is. And she says, in his famous book, The Four Loves, published in 1960, C.S. Lewis talked about this very thing. Friendship is a love that is rationally and freely chosen as you gravitate toward people who share the same interests and passions as you. It's not a relationship that arises out of organic connections, such as mutual affection in families and communities, or the driving need of erotic love that sweeps you away by the impulses of nature. It's a choice made between people who have shared interests that lead to common bonds and deep love. It's a powerful love that enriches people's lives and forms the foundation of a stable society. I could not possibly write or speak a better paragraph about what phileo is, what friendship love is. I want to talk a little bit about that deep friendship kind of love. Now, she talks about different types of people that are very prone to this kind of love, and she uses Myers-Briggs personality types, and I am an ENFP, and ENFPs are definitely one of those people that build these real deep, real passionate, true friendships. So I have always been one who has had a few really, really, really close, super deep, intimate friendships, and I kind of thrive on them. And it's interesting because right now I don't really have that in my life in physical proximity to me the way I normally do. I don't have a local friend that I'm kind of have that quite level of kind of that brother from another mother kind of soulmate kind of relationship with that I've had with people in the past. But, you know, when I was growing up, I had my best friend, Matt. Matt and I were inseparable. He was like he couldn't have been closer to me if he was a brother, you know? And then I had other friends as I was growing up. My friend Kevin and I, from the early 90s through, well, forever, for a really long time, for 10, 15 years, we were so close. We really were kind of Jonathan and David, you know? And we had this really deep, deep personal friendship, you know? And it's interesting because you it usually is people that you kind of gravitate towards, that you admire, that you, there's a mutual admiration, there's a mutual interest. There might be a complementarity in the sense of just like, I tend to find people that in a lot, have a lot in common with me, and we're kind of like twinsies, and we kind of become partners in crime, you know? But there's people that you're just like, you're stoked when they call. You can't wait to see them. You get really excited. You're like, you're just totally rooting for them in a big way, and you want to be around them. You know, for the longest time, I had really close friend, Justin. Now, Justin and I are really good friends still, but he is busy as all get out and lives in Southern California, and I live in Denver. But Justin and I can pick up right where we left off. And I am crazy stoked to see Justin when I see him. And I can't wait to see him. I'm going to see him over Easter. And when I see Justin, I'll give him a big fat bear hug, and I just don't want to let the guy go. I just want to keep him there. I want to hang out with him. I want to talk to him. I want to listen to what he's been going on with him. I want to tell him everything. I almost feel like something, there's a few relationships in my life and where I almost feel like something doesn't happen and something isn't really finished or over until I've had a chance to tell them about that, right? And I think that that's kind of what she's talking about. And so she moves on and talks about how romanticism and puritanism kind of corrupted friendship. How this kind of this weird Puritan Victorian kind of prudishness kind of she says especially in same-sex friendships we're kind of like, you know, discouraged, you know, to have this real deep affectionate relationship. It's funny, it's like you back in the classical era and even, you know, through the medieval era, you would read these letters and see these poems and stuff of friends, sometimes same-sex friends, sometimes friends of an opposite sex that were not involved romantically, and they speak in these really, really, really lofty tones about each other and about their relationship. And that's kind of what was going on in the letters between John Paul II and Anna Teresa Temanieka. They were just speaking very affectionately and very lofty. And I think that our friendships have just gotten so boring and so base that and so banal that anytime we read this stuff, we can't imagine writing that kind of thing. We can't imagine writing that stuff to someone that we were in erotic love with, let alone our best friend or some woman that I'm close friends with that I care about deeply and admire greatly. And so anyway, she goes on and says, the tight control on feelings seeped into our culture, worsened by Victorian aloofness. We became a society that shook hands instead of kissed. Posture, decorum, and propriety put space even in the most intimate associations. And she talks about, you remember when you watch these old shows, Leave It to Beaver, I Love Lucy, these married couples, when they show them in their bedroom, or they show their bedroom, they have separate beds. They couldn't show the marriage bed on television because that was just considered just too much. And then we have this society where everything is sexualized. The most banal stuff is sexualized. Soap is sex. Beer is sex. Cars are sex. Everything is sex. Sex, 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 sex. Everything is all super sexualized. So if the most banal things are sexual, then clearly relationships between people that are deep, deep feelings of love and attraction to that person, those are most certainly, beyond the shadow of a doubt, those are clearly sexual in our mind, right? And so you see, you know, how many times have you seen, two people at a party, they haven't seen each other, you're there, and they say, hey, how are you? What's up? And, you know, they come up and they give each other a big hug, maybe they kiss on the cheek, and they're kind of like, you know, they keep touching each other on the shoulder and on the arm, or maybe they don't quite let go when they hug, and they sit there for a second and they talk, and they're obviously like, there's a physical intimacy between them that is part of this like deep emotional attraction between them. And what happens every single time? What happens? Someone says, gosh, would you guys get a room? Maybe get a room. Gosh, you know, they always make a reference to like, oh, hey, if you guys are going to do that, you know, maybe you should do that in private, because that's, you know, that's not really the kind of, that's joking. Oh, it's not really appropriate out here in front of everybody. And the implied thing is that it's sexual. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get all the way back to Holy Friendship in a Hypersexual World by Bill Donaghy. This might end up being a separate show because I'm just getting too much out of this DC McAllister thing and my own experience of the thing. So now here's what gets interesting. And I think that, and she talks extensively about this, is that in this environment, people that are the kind of people who are really, really attracted to other people and have deeply, deeply personal, kind of like real deep emotional connections to people, strong, strong emotional friendships with a real heavily charged kind of attraction between the people, that they buy into the fact, because of how they've been raised, that that's sexual. And then that can turn into a problem, right? So when we get back, we're going to go to the break. And when we get back, we're going to dive in. I'm not going to try to rush through this. I got to record more. So we'll move on to Holy Friendship in a Hypersexual World by Bill Donaghy on the next show. We'll consider this part one of my ramblings on friendship. So let's go to the break. We'll be back in a second. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. So let's recap where we're at. I started talking about this BBC documentary about John Paul II, that him and his lifelong, over 30-year relationship with Dr. Anna Teresa Temenyeka. Now, the only thing I have against Dr. Anna Teresa Temenyeka, if I'm not mistaken, is that she is the one, or was the one, who is holding up the kind of a little better translation, a little better edition of the acting person. And that's a long story involving the translations and which was supposed to be the official copy, and she was helping him with the book and all this. But, you know, I think we get an edition of the acting person that is a little more, indicative of the thought of John Paul II behind it. And I believe the good Dr. Temenyeka kind of stood in the way of that in a little bit. Though, and this is for the geeky kind of insiders, a professor once told me that if you go read Person in Community, which is a group of writings by young Karol Wojtyła when he was teaching at the University of Lublin in Poland, the last free university in the in Poland, or in the entire kind of Slavic world at the time when everything was held by communism in that area, that when he was teaching there, he wrote all there, it's a bunch of essays, and if you read those essays and you understand how he uses a few particular Latin words like suppositum, then you can read the acting person and you can put it together and figure out where the Dr. Temenyeka, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, has kind of translated some of that Latin into more modern philosophical gobbledygook. But in her defense, that book, The Acting Person, was written for a series of books that were for people who studied, that were specialists in the work of Edmund Husserl. So she was trying to write it in a way and translate it in a way that Husserl scholars would understand it. And this obscure, you're not obscure, it's famous, German phenomenological philosopher, the people who study him wouldn't really understand maybe some of the more Thomistic, you know, the following of St. Thomas Aquinas, the great doctor, the more Thomistic use of these Latin terms. Anyway, there's an aside for who this Dr. Temenyuk is. But evidently he had a lifelong friendship with her, and so this has caused everybody to start talking about whether or not he was in love with her, she was in love with him, or they were in love together or whatever. Both of them, which she has said just out and out, no, he was a middle-aged clergyman and I'm a married woman. No. Didn't have anything to do with that. And there's a radio show, there's an episode worth of just diving into the history between them and that story and John Paul II and his personalism and why this relationship fits his philosophy and what he says we should be to a T. But it kind of started a public conversation around friendship. And in this process, I came across this article, How to Stop Sexualizing Everything, at thefederalist.com by D.C. McAllister. And so we've been talking about friendship and what that is and how it can, in an over-sexualized society, how that can get all jumbled up. And so she goes on and talks about these two guys, Steve and Paul. And they're, and she says that, you know, there's these... If you look at all the people in the world who are homosexual, she says you see that they fall into, the women fall into INFP and INFJ primarily, and the men are ESFJ and ENFJ. And those are Myers-Briggs distinctions. And she talks about that a little bit, about Myers-Briggs. But what's interesting is she says that there's these people have this experience where they want to express their feelings. They feel deeply attracted to persons, and they feel attracted to their people. They love their people. They really, really want to latch onto them and be part of them and express their love to them. And they feel, you know, happy. You know, she describes at the end of her article here, I'm going to skip ahead and go to a section where she says that strong feelings are not always about sex. Where did that go? Bah, 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 bah. Oh, goodness, I can't find it. Never mind. She talks about how... here you go. She says, though I'm an introvert, I need people to fill me up. Just in a more quiet way. My best friend Kate, for example, delights me just by being in her presence. I can talk to her for hours. I leave happier than before I saw her. I love to wrap my arms around her and feel her warmth. I have another friend who is a constant source of joy, and every time I see her name in my email box, I smile. Whenever I go to DC where she lives, I get excited, and the possibility of seeing her, hearing her voice, and watching her expressive brown eyes light up when she laughs. And she says, does that sound gay? Probably you think so, but she's not gay. I'm not gay, she says. I'm 100% straight. We think that being captivated by people, being drawn to people, having this deep, deep love for another person is somehow sexual. And if it happens between people of the same sex, it can throw them into some weird tizzy where they think they must be homosexual. Now, let's go back to Steve and Paul. That's what happens to them, right? They, in her example she uses, they are both these men. They are maybe... they're E's, maybe ENFs, and they're really expressive. They're very outgoing. They love to exhibit their affection. They love to show their affection. They become very, very attached to each other in deep, deep bonded friendship. But they think that they start thinking that, oh, well, that must be sexual because I feel happy when I see him. I feel my heart race when he comes walking in the door. I'm like, I'm excited to be around him. They use this language that we all would flag that language as being sexual language. And so they start thinking, oh, well, maybe it is sexual. Maybe I'm a homosexual. And they start questioning all that. They start wondering what that means. And it's interesting because she points out that a lot of times there's a rise in homosexuality right now. And I think that what's happening is I've said this before, and she says the exact same thing, is that it's this series of false conclusions. You think that a lot of people are homosexual. You think that people who have deep emotional attraction to another person of the same sex, who wants to be around them, that loves when they come around, that can't wait to give them a big hug, and you know, and they admire what they look like, they admire what they can do, they find them charming or whatever, they find them interesting, that those are all sexual things. And if they have those feelings, then they must have sexual feelings for a person of the same sex. Therefore, they must be gay. And in our current culture, if you have that thought, there's a chorus of people cheering you on, going, you're open-minded, you're a good person, you're amazing, you probably are gay, good for you, give me a big gay high five. And, you know, a big gay high five. I'm sorry, I cracked myself up. I'm now being very tempted to start quoting South Park and Big Gay Al's Big Gay Boat Ride. But, you know, they think, oh, yeah, they get all this big cheering section, and they're like, yeah, and you get all this affirmation, and they move on. Now, then what often happens is it's very confusing for them because they don't feel good about it, and they don't feel right about it. They take it to a sexual level, and then it's not a pleasant experience. It's not something that resolves anything for them. And she says that she thinks that there are truly homosexual relationships. I'm going to tend to disagree with her. I think I'm more of a natural law kind of a guy. But she says that she's not talking about them. If it's a true homosexual relationship, when they finally break this barrier and they take this relationship to a sexual level, there will be a relief, so to speak. But often doesn't become a relief. It becomes a much more deeply confusing experience. And so then that same chorus that was cheering them on is going, no, no, keep going. You're just repressed. That's just society disagreeing with you. And they move on. So man, there's so much I wanted to talk about this. We're going to have to do another show about this because I think that part of the reason I think the society is suffering because we don't have these deep friend relationships. I think that a recovery of friendship would bring a real level of intimacy back. And I think that going back to Jonathan and David that I talked about, the scripture says that David loved Jonathan more than he had ever loved any woman up to that point. And people point to that and try to go, see, they had a homosexual relationship. But the writer of the Old Testament puts that right in there in the same book that condemns homosexuality. He's not talking about homosexuality. He's talking about this. He's talking about like Achilles. It was Achilles and Patroclus. In the Iliad, where one would die for the other, right? This is a brotherly friendship love, right? And I think that if we can recover that, I think that you'll have more men with a firmly rooted actual natural masculine character. And B, I think that the intimacy that a lot of people are craving and they're turning to porn and stuff to kind of to get is more than just an absence of sexual relationships. So, man, we didn't get anywhere near what I wanted to cover. So we'll pick this up on the next episode. Let's pull the plug for now, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thank you so much. I feel the pain of everyone.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.